Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Today, we'll be talking about a new University of Texas, Texas Politics Project poll that we just released. To do that, I am happy to be joined by my co-principals and collaborators in this project, Darren Shaw, professor of government at UT Austin. Darren, how are you this morning?
Doing well. Good to see you, Jim.
Warmed up, as we were saying, I think. And Joshua Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Josh, good to see you in the studio.
Very warm.
Very warm. And he's very warm, too. We're going to talk about the poll that we released this week, and we'll go roughly in order of probably at least immediate interest. For those of you out there that are interested and not operating any heavy machinery while you're listening to this, you can browse along the polling results at the Texas Politics Project website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. You can see the latest polling section or pop over to the blog link in that section on the page to see the overview post that we rolled out earlier this week. Well, shall we start with the most in-demand material?
We may as well.
National economic evaluations?
Yeah. Inflation.
Household welfare. So let's start with the trial ballots and election matchups. Of course, the two races getting the most attention in the primary elections are the GOP races for governor and attorney general. Josh, could you maybe just start by giving us a summary of what we found on those races?
Yeah, sure. So looking at the race for governor, I should say this is among likely Republican primary voters here. And for this case, we define these as those voters who have voted in at least one of the last three party primaries and then indicate that they plan to vote in the primary this time, in the Republican primary. And so here, when we look at this, we find Abbott, you know, with, I would say, a solid, though not commanding lead at 60%, Alan West at 15%, former State Senator Don Huffines at 14%, and the remaining candidates at less than 5%. On the AG race, we find Paxton just below the runoff threshold at 47%, but within the margin of error. George P. Bush at 21%, Eva Guzman at 16%, and Representative Gohmert at 15%. So a pretty even spread there. Below the top.
So let's start with the governor's race, the race on the GOP governor's side. What do you make of this, Darren?
Well, I think people are going to read this as, I think, indicating that there's some considerable sentiment in the Republican Party that Abbott is not necessarily the ideal candidate. I just don't actually see that here. I think you've got one fairly well-known, at least in Texas GOP circles, candidate in West. And then Don Huffines, who, for those of you who've been watching the NFL playoffs, seemed to have a commercial every 10 minutes, some of them in very high-profile games.
Money to spend.
Yeah.
Or burn.
So, right. Yeah. So I think, you know, amongst ourselves, we've had this, I think, sentiment for a while that, you know, about two-thirds of the Republican Party is unified behind some of these establishment-type figures, whether that be Rick Perry or, you know, in this case, Greg Abbott.
Not to question anybody's ontological status, but the Rick Perry that everybody knows.
You're correct. Correct.
Right? Not the Rick Perry that's on the ballot.
Not the Rick Perry, surprisingly, up here in the ballot. So that leaves one-third of the Republican Party that is open to challenges that is anti-establishment, however that establishment is defined or embodied by particular candidates. So I'm not terribly surprised by this. I mean, I haven't looked at the campaign finance figures to see how much Huffines has spent. There's an awful lot of, you know, time, energy, and money, capital put into this campaign so far. West has, I think, a fairly well-known constituency, and Abbott's still at 60%. You know, and of course, the issue context for Abbott is you had this massive collapse of the grid last time, so at least one kind of appreciable grievance, and then the candidate's been talking a lot about the situation at the border. So, you know, you would think an incumbent who's been around that long, who's accumulated some performance baggage, and then faces or is at the head of a party that has, you know, very, very strong conservative elements to it that, you know, Abbott has, you know, been able to assuage to some extent. But this sort of represents that, right? This is, you know, very, very strong conservatives, I think, don't think Abbott is kind of a true believer enough. I think there's casual voters who pay attention who either know about West or Huffines who have defected. So, I don't know. Abbott, to me, in this poll is pretty strong. He's considerably above 50%, which is really what you want here. It doesn't seem to be taking on a whole lot of baggage.
I mean, I'm sure there's a pride factor here in wanting to, you know, I'm sure they would really appreciate being over 60 at the end,
yeah,
just for bragging rights. But, you know, right, there's an interesting kind of chicken egg question here that, you know, I think we've all talked about at various, you know, various points in terms of how Abbott has positioned himself in anticipation of just this race, going back really to the first summer of the pandemic. And that,
right,
you know, I think, you know, he long anticipated, I think, that if there was going to be a challenge, it would be from the right. And he has, in a very sustained way, prepared and positioned himself for that, for the race that he finds himself in.
Right. And obviously this almost goes without saying, yet I'll say it anyway. Everything we say here is within the context of sort of political strategy. And so when we say somebody's done something good or been effective, we're speaking to that context, yeah, not talking about policy. But I think Abbott has had, you think about the last 4 years, had a really tricky job in a lot of ways. You had this pandemic that emerged. Then you had this failure of the grid. Those are events that could very easily contribute to
biggish things.
Yes. That could, you know, if you're asking yourself, well, how does a Republican lose in Texas? Well, you know, you have immediate events that the Republican doesn't respond to or
botches.
How about
chaos and collapse?
Yeah, exactly. and so now I know people could point out the opposite and say, like, you know, the pandemic provided opportunities to show leadership, et cetera. And that's obviously true. But, you know, I think Republicans in heavily Republican states or Democrats in heavily Democratic states, they love stasis. They love the lack of crisis challenge because the default is they win and they win fairly comfortably. And Abbott, I think, a very tricky job managing the pandemic, which is how do you be responsive and address this major issue when that involves you and your government doing something in a state where your constituents are suspicious,
right,
of you and the government doing something. And then there's the regional variation in Texas that marked the pandemic as well, which is, you know, a pandemic. What's the appropriate public policy in Houston or Dallas versus, you know, West Texas,
right,
or the border areas? And so, again, I'm not commenting on whether, you know, we think Governor Abbott did the right thing or the wrong thing in certain circumstances. I just think his situation was extremely complicated compared to, let's say, blue state governors like Cuomo or like Newsom, where, you know, a robust public policy response is not only something that shows you're committed to addressing this major issue, but it's also something your core constituency is very comfortable with. Abbott didn't have that luxury.
And in fact, he had the opposite.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
And
yeah,
that guy, you know, we're not going to— that guided policy and the polling we've done over the last couple of years on COVID, Josh, really underlines in stark terms what that dilemma was for him, right?
Yeah,
and actually, I don't think he treated it like a dilemma. I think they looked at what they had and they did it.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I agree with everything that Darren said, and I think I'll just add one thing to this, and, you know, without going into the COVID element of all this. I mean, I think there's a sort of set of the shocks that were thrown upon the system that Abbott had to deal with in the political environment that he faces, and that includes constraints, you know, being a huge state, but also, again, you've got large segments of the Republican Party who are basically saying, don't do anything, right? And that's right, difficult. But if we look at where he is right now and everything that's happened between then and now, we can also look at this poll and say, look, you know, among those same GOP primary voters who give him 60% of the vote, 77% approve of the job he's doing. So there's not, you know, that's not much different than Republicans overall. It's not, you know, his favorability numbers are not terribly different than President Trump's, especially, you know, among Republicans. So, you know, to say that there is an opening, there's an opening. Is it, you know, a big opening? Is it a majority opening? I think, you know, these numbers and everything we've seen through the pandemic indicate clearly not.
And I guess to provide, you know, to underline that point and provide a contrast, let's talk about the AG race,
right,
where Ken Paxton finds himself in a very different position than Greg Abbott does. Comes into this campaign, second campaign in a row with legal and ethical issues hanging over his candidacy. There's no denying that. Some of those were there when he was elected in 2018, to be fair, but not all of them. And those problems have gotten worse. And he finds himself, you know, as Josh was saying, just under 50%. Now, I would almost say tantalizingly under 50%, because I think we had a 48, right? And that's
47, yeah.
47. And he's been in that range in other public polling that we've seen. So what do we make of that race? That's going to be a runoff, right?
I love this result. And when I say I love this result, I mean the same way that Darren meant about good and bad. I love in the sense of looking at politics, because I think this really encapsulates what is going on in this race from a couple perspectives, right? If you take the support for George P. Bush and for Eva Guzman and kind of, you know, lump that together as sort of, you know, either you can either call it, you know, institutional or moderate support. I don't think that's exactly right. I could say, you know, when I say institutional support, I mean, you know, there's a certain share of Republicans who are looking at this and rightly saying, you know, Paxton might be wounded. If Paxton goes through and becomes the nominee in the general election and the FBI investigation goes forward, he could be a liability to Republicans in that, let's say, in the AG's office, but also maybe in general. Who knows? And so that's part of the rationale, I think, there. But if you combine those two, you've got 37% who say, you know, yeah, we should probably, you know, move away from the incumbent. On the other side, you've got Paxton and Gohmert representing about, you know, a little over 60% of the vote here, basically taking that right lane up. And so the other piece that kind of comes out of this to me is to say, you know, Paxton, what you also see in this result is that despite Paxton's legal problems, extensive legal problems that have been going on for an incredible period of time, the fact that he's, you know, developed such a reputation and a brand within the Republican Party, with activists, with conservatives, regardless of all that, he is still at 50%. And when we look at his job approval, again, among those primary voters, 69% approve of the job he's doing. So, you know, he's not in, I mean, I say, relatively speaking, he's not in a bad position, even though we always say an incumbent below 50% is in a bad position.
Right. Yeah, I think normally you look at a guy at 47 and you figure, okay, well, let's assume there's a runoff.
Right.
And right now, you know, Paxton's actually within striking distance of not needing a runoff.
Right.
Which is something.
It's a coin flip-ish right now.
Right. I mean, you know, with our margin of error for, you know, for the listeners who are interested, is we're talking about, you know, 350 roughly, you know, kind of voters in these primaries. Okay. A little higher than that, Josh.
Oh, I was going to say 5 points plus or minus.
Right. So it's a plus or minus five. So when we say, you know, Paxton's at 47, well, you know, this basically the bound is between, you know, 42 and 52. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is he's somewhere in there. So he could, you know,
squeak by.
and that's not even allocating some of the, you know, some of the undecideds or others who are in this race. But certainly if you, and I think Josh is right here, if your instinct is to kind of combine the Paxton and Gohmert votes and say, okay, if Paxton needs a runoff, well, he's basically kind of at 60% in that runoff, assuming turnout dynamic, all that kind of stuff.
There was a reason that Paxton was announcing his latest lawsuit in the middle of Gohmert's district this week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we keep going. I'm going to go even further away from, like, we keep going, we're not talking about policy, we're just talking about the politics. Now I'm going to step back even further and say, I'm not even talking about the politics, I'm talking about how people are thinking about the politics. It's been very interesting to watch people in the political community and in the press move around on this race from the, oh, you know, Paxton's, you know, he's fine. There's no way he's ever going to be in a runoff, too. Oh, he's in a runoff.
Right.
And now to, like, I think we've kind of settled where, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
I would like to say it's an informed, I don't know. But it is interesting. Okay. Do you agree, Josh just mentioned Paxton announcing this latest lawsuit in Gohmert's district. You know, I had Gromer Jeffers on here on the podcast a couple weeks ago from the Dallas Morning News, and we talked a lot about this race. And it was right at that time that Paxton had begun launching attack ads against Gohmert in his district. And it strikes me that, for a while it was tempting to go, maybe they're seeing polling that Gohmert is moving up, and he has moved up. But it seems to me the bigger problem is that Gohmert draws directly from Paxton's assumed core support, and that's why they're trying to drive his numbers down. Does that make sense to you?
I think the logic is correct. The logic you outlined is almost certainly what they're thinking. Yeah, I wonder, though.
They may not be right.
Right. I wonder, though, about, you know, in a primary election, and we should preface all of this by saying that, you know, even in today's kind of hyper-partisan, hyper-polarized environment, everybody's sort of talking about politics, you know, turnout is low in these elections. There's not that many people who are going to vote. I mean, actually, in raw numbers, there will be quite a bit, but as a percentage in Texas, it's just, of registered voters, it's not going to be that high. So the kinds of people who vote are engaged and they're interested, but they're not a random subset of, you know, the Texas population, probably not even of, you know, Republicans in Texas or Democrats in Texas on those respective sides. I tend to think that, you know, the Paxton people, if they see Gohmert moving up, the response is that, well, you know, we need to project ourselves as more conservative because the entire basis for Gohmert's taking out of our chunk is that, you know, we're bleeding conservatives. And that it's probably right demographically, but to your point, Jim, about the cause, is it really the case that conservatives just don't think Paxton has been conservative enough and therefore they're voting for Gohmert? No, I think it's completely related to the ethics challenges and the negative press that's attended to that Paxton has received. And so I wonder about, I mean, you have to do something in a campaign, right? That's why you're paid and you're serving the candidate. But I just wonder if, you know, the conflation there isn't a little too cute, right?
Right.
The real problems are not the ideological purity of Paxton.
The real problems are the real problems, and the real problems are why he has three strong challengers.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, going back to that, you know, there's another kind of chicken egg situation. Like, is he in trouble with the candidates because, you know, there's just more candidates, or because he's in trouble?
Yeah. But this is the whole point, though. But we say all that, and then you look and you say, but he's close to even not,
right.
He's close to the runoff threshold. And it's like, I just want to say, like, that speaks to the power of his brand and within those voters. I mean, it's just, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's a good point, real quickly. You know, the reality is if Paxton were not associated very closely with a particular set of issue positions and ideology, then I think the ethics allegations and you know, charges that he faces would really be damning.
Would have been fatal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he's
and
got...
earlier.
Yeah, bingo. Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't want to leave this part of this discussion, Darren, without plugging your book, The Turnout Myth, since we're having you here to talk about turnout. I owe you that since I sicked a reporter on you last week.
Thank you. Now available at Oxford University Press.
But I also want to then plug your book, but then ask you, like, you have any expectations for turnout?
Yeah, I hadn't.
In the primaries, I mean,
right. I hadn't.
Relative to, you know, the trend.
Sure. I hadn't until the referent that you sicked on me asked me. It was actually a good exercise because I hadn't looked at the numbers recently. I don't know this. So typically, what do you get that drives turnout in a primary? Competitive races on one or both sides. You know, where competitive races mean you have candidates who are raising money and spending money and bringing attention to the race. And when you get a decline in turnout or lower turnout, it's usually because one or both sides don't have a lot of competition going on. So I'm a little struck by, in this particular context, well, we sort of have competitive races on the Republican side and theoretically on the Democratic side. So that would lead you to believe, well, there ought to be decent turnout, except if you actually look at those races and have been following them, how much attention has been given to the Democratic race? I mean, Beto is very much a double-edged sword. He comes in and he brings attention and, you know, probably increases the Democrats' chances of being jazzed about the fall election, but he just crushes interest in the primary.
Yeah, which is a good. So what do you think? Okay, yeah, so yeah. I almost transitioned without holding your feet to the fire.
Let me ask you it this way,
since you've worked on campaigns before, what's your vote target for the statewide Republican race?
That's a good one. I think I would peg Republicans at about 1.4 and Democrats at 1 million. 1.4 million, about 1 million. So collectively, about 2.4 million, which puts us in terms of a percentage at about the 16-17% rate of total registered voters in the state of Texas. That's a slight uptick from the average across midterms, but not quite as high as a percentage terms, I think. I got to check this.
Well, as we had in raw votes anyway, in 2018, it was 1.5 something.
Right. Yeah. So I think we're a little down there just because Beto brought such newness and excitement last time around.
I don't know, but my only prediction is that because it's going to be not, you know, a high percentage number in the trend line, we're going to get a lot of stories after the primaries about the collapse of participation in Texas. That's inevitable. It hasn't. So yeah.
I'm not even going to go there. And I'm already getting student papers on the imputed cause of that, but we'll let that go for now.
Sure.
Okay, so just to run through, as Darren alluded to, Josh, not a lot going on in the other primaries, both you know, where there is probably the most interest, you know, Beto's crushing his opposition. Right. Beto O'Rourke has more than 90% of the vote in that primary race. And evidence in what we in the responses and the pattern of responses we saw that there's just not a lot of formed opinion on the other Democratic races at all, right?
Right. That's right. I mean, just to go back a beat, I'll say this is the one thing that Beto O'Rourke and Dan Patrick have in common is that they look likely to just cruise to renomination without much problem. I mean, we'll see what the eventual number
they're
is.
They're both tall guys.
They're both, well, that's true. They're okay. I'll just let you noodle on that, your list, your listicle of the ways that. Beto and Dan Patrick are similar. Yeah, I mean, the thing that really, you know, this is so difficult. I mean, as Darren was just saying, I mean, on the one hand, you've got Beto at the top of the ticket, who seems to basically be a consensus pick among Democrats. And he's extremely well-known and well-liked amongst, you know, primary voters, Democratic voters. And then, you know, we go, and the way we ask these questions is we always allow people to tell us at the outset, well, I haven't thought about that race, but the primary's coming up. So if you vote in primaries and you plan to go, then we say, okay, but really, if you had to choose, and that's how we report our results, as if the person were in the voting booth, they're going to make a choice. But on the race for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor, the majority, 57%, didn't have an opinion at first. On the AG side, it was 52%, didn't have an opinion at first. And so, you know, the results still carry through in the sense, like, you know, for the most part, the person who was in first, you know, at least in the, I'll say this, the lieutenant governor's race, you know, in both the initial question and then when we force him to follow up, Mike Collier's in the lead. This shouldn't totally surprise us. He's ran statewide two times. Like, he has at least some knowledge. There's knowledge within the Democratic electorate of who he is, at least a little bit. The AG race, I think, is a total mess to some extent, right? In the sense that, you know, when we ask initially, who are you going to support? Rochelle Garza gets 15%, Jaworski gets 16%, and Lee Merritt gets 8%. Once we go and force people, Rochelle Garza jumps to 41%, Jaworski jumps to 24%, Merritt goes to 15%. And I mean, I just, you know, I mean, I think there's a big part of this, which is I tell people all the time, you know, when people say, oh, well, if a woman jumps in the race or if there's a Hispanic on the ballot, well, isn't that just going to throw everything? I say, you're saying, no, not really. Not if people know who the candidates are. But if people don't know who any of the candidates are, in the case like this, there's one person on the candidate who's on the ballot who will be identifiable as a woman. There's one person on the ballot who is identifiable as a Hispanic.
In a Democratic
primary. In a Democratic primary here. It's not surprising that she gets this extra boost. And the question is going to be, is that going to, you know, be enough to kind of keep her there? We'll see. I mean, more than anything, I think what we expect is runoffs in both of those races, which is going to make it even harder for Democrats to compete in November.
Yeah. Look, I think on the Republican side, what you see is, you know, well-known incumbents kind of anchoring the ballot. And then in a couple of the races, certainly in the AG race and certainly in the gubernatorial race, you have other candidates who are reasonably well-known, either by virtue of spending, you know, millions of dollars like Huffines, or just having a family name like Bush, right? But on the Democratic side, you're right. Democratic voters are searching for cues. How do I construct an opinion? Mm-hmm. How do I figure out who to vote for in a race where I don't really know any of the candidates? And so I think, you know, we're actually very sympathetic to the kind of dilemma that voters face in this situation, which is, you know, I think it would be good for the Democrats to nominate a woman, whether for representation reasons or strategic reasons. Maybe I, you know, think that Hispanics need to be more, so I'm going to favor the Hispanic candidate. I think, you know, sometimes people's flash reaction is, well, that's just silly to vote on the basis of these things. But when you pull back a little bit and ask, well, what are you supposed to do in a race where you don't really know anything about the candidates? Is it ridiculous to use these small bits of information to construct an opinion? And I think we're all very sympathetic to that.
And you've got some damn pollsters saying, no, really.
Yeah.
and especially, you know, and if you do think about those sort of things, but you are, you know, but you don't have information about these candidates, you know, you probably just selected Beto O'Rourke as your Democratic nominee. There's a good chance you just selected Mike Collier as your lieutenant governor nominee. Now you get to a race of, you know, a bunch of people you don't know. And it's like, well, okay, got one white guy, two white guys. You know, what are we doing here? And part of it is you say, you know, sometimes does this matter or not? But look, this is the Democratic Party in Texas is a majority female, majority non-white party. So there is a problem at some point if you keep putting up tickets where you have white male after white male after white male in terms of, I think what the Democratic messaging is. So it is a real consideration. But in this case, I mean, what we're really talking about here is people don't know who these candidates
right.
are is the main takeaway.
So let's move. I guess we can't move away from this without talking about what we got in the hypothetical matchup between Greg Abbott and Beto O'Rourke. You know, we say hypothetical, but obviously per this conversation, it's a very high probability outcome that's what we're going to see after March. You know, and we had, you know, Abbott ahead by 10. 47-37.
I'll point out exact same gap that we saw between Abbott and Davis in February of 2014.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a good little factoid.
I'm just here for that.
So what do we make of this?
You know, it's interesting. You've got in Greg Abbott, a fundraising dynamo, a candidate who has, you know, run and won elections in Texas across multiple races. You have Beto O'Rourke, who is, you know, if Abbott's a fundraising dynamo, then, you know, whatever the level up above dynamo is certainly what O'Rourke is. Very well-known run, I guess if you count the presidential, you know, in the two most recent, 2018 and 2020, has run statewide/national campaigns. And yet what you end up with is kind of a party line vote here. You know, about a 10-point spread. If you allocate undecideds proportionally, it's about a 12-point spread. That's kind of what you would expect, even as Texas trends less, reliably red. It's, you know, maybe slightly actually above what one would expect nowadays, right? That is, Josh and I and Jim had this conversation 10 years ago, I think we probably would have said the baseline Republican beats the baseline Democrat by 10 to 12 points. And I think in recent years, it's come down to 7, 8, or 9 or something.
I widen my band and say 10 to 12 points plus or minus 2. It's like 10 to 14. But I think that's exactly the point here, right? Which is, you know, historically, we would look at these races, especially early on, and you'd see, you know, at least a 10-point lead for the Republican candidate. If it was less than that, you'd say, is that an odd measure? Does that have something to do with, like, when we polled? Is there something particular about that candidate or those sets of candidates? But then the idea is that as the race would go on, we would see, like in the case of the Davis, Abbott got bigger, right? So Davis ends up losing by almost 20. I think the question is now, if we're starting at about a 10-point gap, do we expect that gap to grow or to get slightly smaller? And I think, you know, looking at, again, the underlying numbers here, I would expect it to get slightly smaller, given that I think O'Rourke is probably underperforming a little bit with groups he's going to have to work on. But that's all to say there's a whole campaign season to see whether that number grows or shrinks. But I think this is where we expect these things to kind of start. And that's the other point here. We're still 7 months from the election. This is the start. They're not even the candidates. This is a hypothetical.
Yeah, to Josh's point, you know, we talk about partisan sorting. And a lot of what we think about campaigns in political science these days is that the campaign provides an opportunity for people to kind of remind themselves or to be reminded of where they, quote, should be, unquote, right? So I'm a Democrat. I will eventually move to O'Rourke as the campaign heats up and I kind of remember, you know, Democrats versus Republicans and why I associate myself with the Democratic Party. What's interesting now is that's already happened in a lot of it. Now, not entirely, as Josh said, O'Rourke is actually underperforming here with some key constituencies. But basically, the sorting that we typically, back in the day, would expect to occur in October and late October and early November, it's already happened.
Yeah.
So I would not be surprised if this is a steady state race all the way up into the cycle. I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of, absent some major events, a lot of oscillation in support for O'Rourke and Abbott over the course of this campaign. I will say that, you know, it's interesting. O'Rourke, though, has a lot of baggage here, maybe more so than Abbott, even though Abbott's been around considerably longer. It just, again, continue to be amazed at how short the windows of opportunity are in American politics these days. You know, O'Rourke was such a force in 2018, and now it feels like he's been around forever. You know, it feels like, boy, he lost in 2020. There seems to be this kind of notion that, oh God, is he running again? And I think that's something he's going to have to fight a little bit against. And, I do think there are some things he's done, which we can talk about, that are very smart in terms of positioning. But we can get into
this. I was reading something this morning. I can't remember the beginning of the quote is, but the end of the quote is, you know, like in strategy, there's nothing worse than a mistake. And O'Rourke made a big mistake. And, you know, and he's still kind of paying for that. I mean, but the other side of it is, you know, Abbott has such control over the media environment, or over his media environment and his ability to define O'Rourke, in a way that's just going to make it, I mean, it's a challenge that Democrats always face. The difference is that, you know, I think Republicans take O'Rourke seriously. And so it's just, you know, they've been spending since the summertime trying to redefine him, especially amongst, lower propensity voters, amongst independents, amongst suburbanites, that he's just too extreme for Texas. And, you know, if you take that on the heels of the presidential campaign.
That's the big point.
And if we look at the fave unfaves we ran on Beto O'Rourke, that campaign among Democrats or among Republicans has worked. And it's also, I think, borne some fruit among independents, which, of course, in Texas, even true independents are going to lean towards the right. So, you know, we spend most of the time talking about the campaigns. I'm just going to let's end this by just saying I'm just going to ask you guys, and I'll give you a second to think. I'll vamp for a second. Pick out an issue you guys thought was an issue result you guys thought was interesting and telling about where we are right now. And for those of you that haven't looked at the poll yet, we polled very broadly on a lot of issues. You know, I think we flagged that the public education has really been back in focus again in a very different way than it has been in the recent past in Texas. One might argue that, you know, if you've been around a while, we've seen this movie before, but we've shifted from, you know, a real focus on funding distribution, a systemic focus that we saw in the legislature in the last couple of sessions, certainly in if not the last session, the two before that, to a return to looking at content and the schools as a political kind of battlefield underlined by what we've seen during the pandemic. We also asked about positions on abortion, on guns, on voting laws, on sort of national systemic issues, democracy. January 6th, the Biden, the 2020 election, et cetera. So there's a lot to look at, and we'll be unpacking this in the podcast and in writing in coming weeks. But so Josh, what struck you on the issue front? And we got just a couple of minutes. So,
yeah, you know, that's great stuff. I don't want to highlight a specific result. I mean, you mentioned so many of them. They're all really interesting. I think, you know, what I look at when I look at these policies in this poll, we were trying to figure out kind of here we are in the transition from, you know, what the legislature did in that year of legislating into the campaign season and how that plays out. And what strikes me is, you know, I agree with Darren. There's a bit of a steady state right now. We're kind of watching where things move. And as we polled throughout the session and into this poll, I mean, one of the difficulties we faced this whole time has been, well, you know, which of the many issues that have come up should we even poll on? And I think what I've been trying to figure out throughout all of this is sort of, you know, how are people, voters, dealing with all of this information, and how is it going to, if at all, what parts of it are going to make their way through the campaigns and be effective or not? You know, abortion's a great example, right? Where we have a majority of Texas voters who say, you know, that they do not support an outright ban on abortion should the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade. Well, that's very likely going to happen during this campaign season. What effect does that have on the campaign? I don't know. And so before I thought there might be kind of a death by a thousand cuts when you have a bunch of issues where you have majority opposition or even significant shares of Republican opposition. Now, I mean, I think part of it is it's too many things, but the question becomes, okay,
what's the thing?
What is the thing?
And there's, is there a thing? Is there a thing that disrupts the steady state?
And if you look across this poll, you can find a lot of areas where there could be a thing.
Yeah. Will there be an exogenous shock?
Oh, yeah.
That was for you, Ross Ramsey, yes. If you got this far. Darren, what's on your mind about this? What's your big takeaway?
Well, let me go broadly speaking to sort of echo Josh's point, although with maybe a little bit of a different twist. You know, in a state where Republicans are generically favored by 8 to 12 points, where, you know, the other side, the Democrats own the federal government, you know, the administration and the Congress, you're heading into a midterm election where, I think Democrats in the state of Texas are greatly disadvantaged. Everything that's going on at the national level that is unsatisfying or dissatisfying to people is laid at the footsteps of a party that really needs issues to cut their way to make headway in Texas. And so I'd kind of echo what Josh said, but with a slightly different twist, which is absent something like that, absent a set of issues that undercut Republican, you know, kind of dominance in Texas, it's difficult to see how how a candidate like Beto O'Rourke or some of the other candidates, you know, gets enough leverage to, you know, to make something happen. On the specifics, there were two results I really thought were interesting. One gets at our general point, and those of you who've listened to Jim and Josh and I talk about Texas opinion are probably sick of hearing this, but the subtlety and nuance to opinion in Texas is really striking. Again, having said, oh, it's a, you know, by default a Republican state, that doesn't mean it's a state that's enormously ideological in how they view some of the day-to-day problems. So, for instance, we asked a pretty cutting-edge issue about education today. So the statement, we asked people to agree or disagree with the following statement. Parents of children in Texas public schools have enough influence on what their children are taught. Now, this is kind of a litmus test for, you know, are you buying into the what we saw in Virginia and other places where there's apparent rebellion occurring? Well, we ended up with, you know, about the same number, actually within one percentage point, of people agreeing and disagreeing with that statement.
And I want to say, you know, we ask intensity on that.
Yeah.
And the majority of the opinion was in the middle, somewhat agree, somewhat disagree. So it's very normally distributed. And I think, you know, this reflects like this is a pretty new issue that's being thrust upon a lot of people, and they're trying to kind of figure out
right
how to react to it.
Right. So I'd point to that result. And then the second result was we continue to ask people about voting rules in Texas. And I'll give credit to my co-principals here because I like what they have done. I think they were the ones who formulated the response option here, which is rather than talk about mail-in versus in-person voting versus extended, they simply asked, should the voting laws be more strict, less strict, or left as they are? And you basically get a one-third, one-third, one-third divide on this.
That's really consistent, too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I think, speaks to, now, of course, there obviously represents differences in opinion, but I think also shows that people are trying to grapple with these things. There's not lopsided opinionation on these sort of difficult issues just because we're in a traditionally red state.
Yeah, and I think that's good for the, you know, weighing into the storyline that people often want to write that either the state is running in one direction,
right,
and that's why government is run by one party, or one party is pushing the public in a direction they don't want to go,
yeah,
and what's up with that? It's a very complicated landscape out there, and the parties in the election are looking for comparative advantage in what is front and center for people. But a lot of these issues that have been front and center are, as Josh says, very new. And I think we're going to continue to see movement in some of these things are already set, but we're going to see movement in others. So with that, I want to thank Darren and Josh for being here. Thank our excellent production team in the audio studio in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at UT Austin. Remind everybody you can find all these results we've talked about and much, much more at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.